I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. It's a simple rule, one that's been repeated to us over and over and over again on TV ads, highway billboards, and by our mothers. Don't drink and drive. Yet people break that simple rule on a surprisingly regular basis. By some estimates, one in three people will be involved in an alcohol-related crash in their lifetime. With that in mind, public health professor Baron Lerner set out with a bottle of vodka, a shot glass, and a breathalyzer to see how much alcohol was legally allowed. Turns out it's more than you might think. Today, Lerner joins us alive on the program. And later, Brian McTavish brings us the weekend to-do list, a list best enjoyed responsibly. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Looking back on it now, Baron Lerner wonders how the situation was tolerated for so long. That situation is drunken driving. And here's the really amazing thing. Even now, with a national blood alcohol limit of 0.08, it's downright amazing how much liquor some people can drink before they reach that level. In other words, for some, the battle against drinking and driving hasn't reached an endpoint. The estimates these days are that there are still more than 80 million car trips taken each year by impaired drivers. Baron Lerner is a professor of medicine and public health at Columbia University. He's written a new book, One for the Road, Drunk Driving Since 1900. And welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you.
Well, just before you finished this book, you decided to do one last thing, Baron, and that was to get drunk yourself. And you did that not to celebrate wrapping up the book, but to learn something about blood alcohol levels. What did you learn?
Well, what I decided to do was to simulate almost what it would be like to drink a lot and then think about driving. So I enrolled my wife in the little experiment, and we sat in the kitchen, and I started drinking vodka. I had three shots on an empty stomach and got up to a blood level, I think, of about 0.04, 0.05. At that point, I felt buzzed.
Just three shots, and you're only at 0.05. Again, the legal limit is 0.08, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know exactly where I'm going. Two more shots, five total, got me to 0.08. So what that said to me, and by that point I was pretty blitzed and not at all capable of going in a car or anything like that.
Right.
And what that told me is you have to try really, really hard to get up to 0.08. And I think people sometimes think, you know, you have a couple of drinks and you could be stopped and arrested, but you have to drink a lot on an empty stomach in order to get to the legal limit in this country.
You know, see, that surprised me, the introduction that you made to the book, because I was under the impression, obviously, perhaps erroneously here, that when the standards were lowered to 0.08, that somehow really put a capper on this thing, and you really couldn't drink and drive much anymore, and you're saying just the opposite is true.
Exactly. That's right. That's why so many countries have gone, for example, to 0.05, which is more equivalent to roughly two drinks for an average person. You know, and there, you know, it would be safer. I'm certainly not advocating it, but 0.08 is still a pretty high number.
Well, is there any push in this country? Because again, as someone who covers politics here, I haven't heard much lately about any more pushes to go from 0.08 down to 0.05, for instance. Is anyone heading there?
You're absolutely right. And that's really a political issue. The question is, do you want, as activists against drunk driving, to focus your efforts on that sort of thing? And I think that MAD and the other organizations at this point have said no. Getting a limit of 0.05 probably would save some lives, but it would create a negative impression in this country that we were being too prohibitionist, that we were stamping on people's liberties. And so I think that there's other emphasis going on now. For example, new technologies to try to, instead of urging people sort of with a moral code of trying to not drink and drive, but to use technologies that might actually prevent people from being able to drive drunk in their cars.
In other words, you can't turn the ignition on unless you blow in a little machine. And if you register too high, you can't. The car won't start.
Exactly. That's one of them that's called the ignition interlock. And that's now used for people who've been convicted of DWI. But theoretically could be used for a broader population as well.
I was going to say, is there any talk about making that standard operating equipment on new cars?
No, but there is talk, and this is going to be an issue in the next 5 to 10 years, of other technologies that might be able to detect alcohol in your blood when you put your hands on the steering wheel. So,
wow.
I don't know that much about it, but it's an infrared technology, and supposedly you put your hands on the wheel, it can detect through sweat or something how much that you have alcohol in your system, and the car won't start. So theoretically, if that technology was good enough, Detroit could put that into cars, and we could probably get a big handle on drunk driving.
Is that national standard, the 0.08, did Congress pass that, or is it simply a matter of all 50 states having adopted it by now?
That's an interesting story. Basically, all 50 states have passed it, but it took federal arm twisting to do it. The way pretty much all the drunk driving, many of the drunk driving laws have passed in this country is by the federal government withholding highway safety funds.
You don't get
states.
Our money unless you comply with the lower the standard.
Exactly. There. And if people remember in 1984 when the drinking age was raised from 18 to 21, that was the same technique that the feds used to say you better raise it to 21 or you're not getting money for this, and the states comply.
What was the last state to go to 0.08? Do you know off the top of your head?
No, but the states in general out west have been among the slowest. Montana, Utah actually not. Utah has been very progressive, partly due to the Mormon influence. Mm-hmm. But some of the other states out west were reluctant. But by I think 2000, 2002, everybody had pretty much gone to 0.08.
I was going to ask you, how long has it been that way then? Yeah, how many people a year in this country die at the hands of a drunk driver?
This is an interesting question, and we could debate it forever and ever. It's really hard to put a number on this, in part because, as I point out in the book, you know, if you've had a drink or two, but you also didn't sleep very much the night before and you get into a crash, well, was that due to alcohol or was it due to the fact you were too tired? And having said that, the experts at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, who know the most about this, estimate roughly 11,000 people still a year die due to alcohol on the roads. That's way down from 1980 when it was estimated to be about 20,000-25,000, but it's still a substantial number.
You know, what's amazing to me as you think about this is just the public perception of drunken driving, you know, going back, you know, 20-30 years. It seems like when I was younger, Barron, that, you know, the idea of getting convicted for a DUI, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal. You know, it happens sometimes. And today, boy, what a black mark it has become. You get one of those and somehow you're seen as something of a misfit. Am I right about that? And why the perception change?
Well, that's certainly one of the main accomplishments, I think, of MAD and the other groups is to change drunk driving from something that, you know, was almost a male rite of passage where, you know, you would go out with your high school friends or your college friends and drink and see how much you could drink and drive and get home safely. And what these organizations said is, you know, that's ridiculous. You're even if you get home safe, you're committing a crime and you're putting people's lives at risk. Mm-hmm. And that's not a way to demonstrate manliness and masculinity. And so now you're right. I think we've gotten to a point where when people try to get into cars and they've been drinking, we're more likely as a society to try to prevent them, think back to what we've learned from organizations like MAD.
Well, I want to invite our listeners to chime in here. Is it time to lower the blood alcohol limit for determining drunken driving from 0.08 to 0.05%. What do you think about that? 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. I'm just looking at a couple of the calls we have in the queue right now, Barron, and we'll get to Ken from Lee Summit in just a second. He's already questioning how much alcohol it takes to reach the 0.08 limit. He's saying he's an attorney. He was at 0.08 after just a couple of drinks. I'm just wondering, that sort of raises the question, and we'll get to Ken in just a moment. It raises the whole issue of different people react so differently to alcohol in their systems. What do we know about that?
That's a very good point. I did that experiment myself, and I don't claim to that my body processes alcohol exactly like everybody else's, and it's very different. And indeed, ironically, some of the people who tolerate alcohol the best are very, very heavy drinkers. So people who drink a lot and then all the time and then go out drinking probably can do a better job behind the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's not an argument for letting those people drive, even if they're good. I don't think that's a wise choice from a societal perspective. But it is true that part of the reason that we've not gone down probably to 0.05 is that there is variability in how different people process alcohol. And it can be safe for someone, for example, to have a couple drinks and not safe for another person.
So it's such an arbitrary number in a sense, 0.08, 0.05. I mean, having that same standard apply to everyone, how problematic is that?
It's somewhat arbitrary. There's a lot of studies that have been done, and most of the studies that I read certainly show that if you're at 0.05, mm-hmm. most people will be what we might call buzzed. In other words, they probably would be able to drive pretty competently, especially if nothing surprises them on the road, and they'd probably be able to get home, but they're not 100% in control of their faculties. So that's why I think a lot of the European countries have focused on 0.05 mm-hmm. as a number that they want to do. What's striking in this country and interesting to me is why we have chosen to make that limit of 0.05, which is we might call the level of inebriation or impairment, different than the legal limit, which we've chosen to put at 0.08, which is higher.
Yeah. It is amazing. I don't drink a whole lot, but at dinner occasionally I have a glass of wine. I tell you, half a glass of wine, I'm feeling it. I mean, there's no question about it.
Exactly. And, you say to yourself, that's true. And again, you may metabolize alcohol in a particular way, but lots of people who feel that continue to drink and then get in their cars.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's scary.
Should we be considering lowering the blood alcohol limit from 0.08 to 0.05? 816-235-2888. Let's go to some calls here. Ken from Lee Summit. And Ken, I apologize if I preempted your call. I just wanted to talk a little bit what you were raising. But go ahead.
You did a pretty good preamble to my constitution, and your guests also addressed something I was going to segue into. But indeed, as he already addressed, people's body mass indexes are different, and everybody is different. I've seen people, and myself included, with just two drinks. I have a breathalyzer in my office where I can actually reach 0.08. But a bigger point that your guest touched on that I want to make is the discriminatory nature of this, because it is such a written in sand a type of law. A gentleman that's a Teamster truck driver who's been drinking five beers after work every day for 30 years versus a teenager who goes out and drinks his first six-pack when he's 16 years old at a prom night
right. Is
a whole different thing. That Teamster has driven home perfectly for 30 years, can easily handle it, yet technically if he were ever unlucky enough to be pulled over, he will get arrested because he is under 0.08.
And,
but there is no room in the law for those type of distinctions. And by the way, I make my living off of this, so it's kind of sad that I'm saying this, but it also has turned into, across all 50 states, into a multi-million-dollar money-making machine, particularly as the economy has gotten bad over the years.
Mm.
They use crimes, and particularly DUI is a very easy one. Who wants to lobby for drunk drivers? Nobody wants to lobby for them. So they do all kinds of absurd things, and people who don't have a lot of money get punished. One example. If a judge sentences you to probation and a $1,000 fine and you don't have the $1,000, they'll put you in jail in lieu of having that $1,000.
Look, Well, Ken, what's the solution then? What do you recommend? Having worked in this field for a while, where would you go with it?
I would go to back to the 0.10 where we were before. That is definitely one change that I am in favor of. There's too many people that come into my office and say, gee, I wake up at 0.08. 0.08 and let alone 0.05 is such a low barrier, literally certain colognes can give that off. You talk about touching the steering wheel, Aquavelva will come in at 0.05 if you happen to be wearing that cologne. So
Ken, if some people are impaired, though, at 0.05 or 0.08, including Barron, our guest here, what about that?
That's a tough question. This is a big, large, universal macroeconomic question. I don't know that I necessarily have all of the answers for it, but I do think that clamping down and getting tighter and tighter and tighter with no room for variance is something that has to happen. Otherwise, we're going to keep locking up people and spending money on people, some of whom are barely over the edge. I'm not talking about the repeat offenders. I'm talking about some people who are barely over the edge with zero records. The Teamster is a good example. I literally had one a year ago just like that. And he was on the way home after stopping at the VFW after just a couple of beers, as he had for 29 years, and had the cop not pulled him over because of a light missing. He would have made it home safely and nicely and finally. Nothing would have happened.
Yeah, but that's all fine, Ken. But if he's not operating at a full capacity of his capability, shouldn't we have an issue with that?
Well, we should. And if that's the case, then we literally should not be selling liquor or have anybody allowed to drive out of any bar or restaurant that serves liquor in America. Then if we're going to go that way, if you want to take that attitude, a zero tolerance attitude, because by definition, everybody who's parked in front of every bar and tavern in this city and every city in America is in there having a cocktail. Or two, or three. And indeed, if it's going to be 0.05, I guarantee you most of them are going to be at 0.05. It takes very little to get most humans to 0.05.
Right.
So,
Ken, I appreciate the phone call.
We don't want to go to prohibition, do we, Steve?
Yeah, I appreciate the phone call, Ken.
Thank you.
Well, what about that idea, though, what Ken just raised? You know, all these drivers sitting outside of bars at 5 o'clock every night, you know, if half of them are going home impaired, you know, a lot of people might say, well, maybe it's time to deal with that, too.
It's a very hard question. Certainly, police departments have many things to do. So there are probably an infinite number of arrests that could be made. So there's a random element to it. And I think in the world of deterrence, which is what we try to do with drunk driving, we say, look, we can't catch everybody. We don't really want to catch everybody. We don't have enough jail space. We don't have enough courtroom time. Let's send a message, a societal message, saying we find this to be unacceptable.
And that message has been received, I think, hasn't it? Because I know when I'm at a party, I'm way more cognizant today than I was 20 years ago of how much I've had to drink.
You are. Not everybody is.
Okay.
Because that statistic you quoted at the beginning of 80 million, and now it's actually been raised up to 110 million by the CDC for people who drive drunk. So it's variable.
And that's 110 million car trips a year.
Exactly.
By impaired drivers.
Yes,
yeah.
That was the latest CDC estimate. That was, which is probably a little bit on the low side too.
Mark writes this: MU football coach Gary Pinkel was arrested on a Wednesday night. On Friday, just 2 days later, he had reached a plea deal whereby, one, he did not have to serve jail time or pay a fine, and two, he was placed on 2 years probation. I have also heard that part of the deal was that results of this blood alcohol test will not be released to the public. How common is it to resolve DWI charges that quickly, and is it common to withhold the results of blood alcohol tests from the public?
This is a great question and a big topic. It's something I tried to address a lot. By the way, people interested in that, this was pointed out to me yesterday. The Boston Globe just did a big three-part series on people getting out of DWIs all throughout Boston and Massachusetts, which I just read last night, and it's pretty scary. But it's the same sort of thing that's being discussed here. It's very, very, very common for plea bargaining for DWIs.
Well, the whole system has always been kind of game that way.
Exactly.
It's been game for years. Certain people, lawyers,
yes,
who work in that world, know how to get you a break, and you pay them money and they get you off, right?
It's true. And, you know, look, people benefit from having good defense lawyers for a lot of things. I do think in the world of DUI, we've gone too far in the direction of gaming the system. I think that, yes, you can make clever arguments and convince a jury that, yes, he just did this for the first time, and why would you – he's a family man, and, you shouldn't take away his car, and all sorts of arguments that have been made for years and years.
Of course.
But the danger there is that these folks go out and drive drunk again, and the data clearly show that the first time someone is pulled over for drunk driving, it is not the first time they've done it. It's probably the 100th time they've done it.
Wow. Back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Richard from Overland Park. Richard, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I had a question regarding the complicity that the establishments, restaurants, bars have in serving. Obviously, they don't take responsibility for the actions, you know, after they leave the establishment. I wonder if that could be something to work on, as in, you know, there's certain places you go, you valet your car, and they give you your keys back, and there's a process there. And I wonder if there could be something like a breathalyzer. Point being, I wonder how many people drive drunk that wouldn't drive drunk if they knew they were over 0.8, meaning they could have an opportunity to test their take a breathalyzer, either go back for an hour, drink some water, whatever the case is, until they're under the limit. Point being, people that are, you know, for example, between, you know, 0.80 and 1.0, perhaps if they had an opportunity to know that, they would not drive. Because they did not know that and felt fine, they did drive. The guy that weighs 300 pounds but drank six beers may be over the limit and feel completely, you know, just maybe a little buzz and feel fine to drive. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Richard, thank you.
This raises a couple of very interesting issues. One is the role of restaurants. There are many laws in this country. They're originally called dram shop laws.
That's right.
That technically prohibited restaurants and waiters from serving inebriated people and potentially make establishments liable. What's hard is that those things are not prosecuted very often in this country, in part because they're very hard cases to make. It's difficult, even when servers have been trained in this sort of area, to get them to not serve people. It's a deterrent that potentially is there but doesn't work very well. I will tell you that in other countries, particularly Australia, they are fanatical about prosecuting establishments that serve people and let them go drunk. One other point, Australia, again, does have breathalyzers in bars, and people use them regularly before they leave the establishments to check themselves, because it is a huge stigma in Australia to drive drunk, and they have roadblocks set up all over the country to catch people.
Why is it such a big deal in Australia? What brought that about?
You know, it's a cultural thing. Mm-hmm. They from the get-go knew that there was heavy drinking going on, and the political leaders there and the activists were able to stigmatize this. In this country, we have done experiments putting breathalyzers into bars in some cases, and in many instances, people used it as a bar game. They would go to the breathalyzer, they drink a bunch of drinks and see who could get to a higher blood alcohol level. So that sort of said it all about sometimes the futility of trying to control drunk driving in this country.
We're visiting with Baron Lerner. He's author of a new book, One for the Road, Drunk Driving Since 1900. Laura from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. I'm a recovering alcoholic with 10 years of sobriety, and one of my biggest regrets is when I drove drunk, and I was never arrested. And I really couldn't disagree more with that former caller, Ken. I sit in a lot of meetings with those Teamsters who it took just that one time for them to realize that all these years they have had a problem. So I really think that lowering it to 0.5 is a good idea.
Okay, Laura, thank you very much. And I should point out that Baron will be speaking this evening at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. For more information or to RSVP for this event, go to kcur.org/up-to-date. The lecture is sponsored by the History and Philosophy of Medicine Department at the KU Med Center. Again, tonight, 6:30, the Plaza Branch at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here, and we'll get phone calls from Rick, Claire, and Jake. We'll also talk about the case of Margaret Mitchell, the author of Gone with the Wind, who died at the hands of a drunk driver. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about the upcoming presidential elections with Wall Street Journal's Jerry Seib or any of our previous programs, you can find them all on our website, kcur.org/uptodate. On tomorrow's program, the film critics are back. We end the week with a rundown of the latest art, independent, and foreign films, as well as documentaries. Be sure to join us for that. This hour, we're talking with Baron Lerner about drunken driving. He has a new book out, One for the Road, Drunk Driving Since 1900. He speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. And Baron, some folks will wonder that perhaps you've written this book. They'll assume that you wrote it because perhaps you yourself lost a loved one to a drunk driver. Is that the case?
No, fortunately, I haven't had any direct personal experience with this. Although people, after reading the book, assumed that I did because I seemed very preachy, I guess.
Yeah.
But I have done a lot of work in public health and the history of public health. So I've been interested for a long time in the issue of how we balance protecting public's health and honoring people's civil liberties. And this seems to be such a perfect example.
I was going to say that you couldn't find an issue that's more in the crosshairs of what you just described than this one probably, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, what's the right of someone to have a couple of drinks and get behind the wheel if the odds are nothing bad's going to happen, but there's a slight chance that there is? I mean, who gets to decide whether that's right or wrong?
Dan, a 17-year police veteran in Missouri, writes us this, Baron. I wanted to point out that the 0.08 blood alcohol content is not required for a conviction for drunken driving. Police and prosecutors only need to prove driver impairment, and impairment starts with that first drink. Hundreds of people are convicted each year and blow under 0.08. And I got to admit, I'm not sure I knew that either.
Yes, that's true, and that's a very important point. And every state has different laws, which leads to a little bit of confusion. But a lot of states have DUI driving while under impairment at 0.05 or even less. Mm-hmm. And people there are convicted based on, for example, an inability to do roadside sobriety tests in various ways. I will say, though, while I agree with that comment, those cases tend to be the ones that get thrown out or pled down more often just because the person was at 0.04 and it was their first time, and maybe the police officer, you know, said that they were unsteady, but the defense lawyer says that they were steady and that sort of thing. So those cases are harder to convict
because
than
it's so much more subjective.
It's
at
more
that
subjective,
point.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Rudolph writes this: where can people buy a breathalyzer so they can measure this stuff themselves? Should people have even access to breathalyzers so they can know for real? The problem is that people do not know if they're at 0.08 or 0.05 or at 0.1 blood alcohol level.
I'm so glad that got asked.
Yeah.
When I did my little experiment, I bought my breathalyzer on Amazon.com, and I looked at the comments and I got one that wasn't too cheap because I wanted to make sure it worked. I think it cost me $30 or $40. It's very accurate. I would encourage everybody to go get one. Why not? I mean, if you are at a party, you know, you don't have to blow it in front of everyone. You can go into the bathroom or something and use it. And sure, find out what you're at. I think people's ability to predict what they're at and how safe they can drive, especially when they've been drinking, is not reliable.
What happened to Margaret Mitchell, the author of Gone with the Wind?
This is such a sad story.
Yes, it is.
And people really, I think, don't remember it. She died in 1949. She was still, I think, in her 50s when she was going to the theater with her husband, and a car sped, an off-duty taxi driver sped down the street and hit her. It turned out that he had had over 20 previous arrests for bad driving. Some were related to alcohol, and some were related to speeding, driving on the wrong side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
The police said that they smelled alcohol in his breath. He apparently was not breath tested after the Margaret Mitchell event, and she died as a result. And it's so incredibly sad. It seemed at one point it was going to be an opportunity for the country to come together and really try to get drunk driving front and center. It didn't happen. And the reason, which I think is very important, is that for years and years, until really MAD and these other groups came along, drunk driving was seen as an accident. People who got hit by cars were seen as being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Wow.
And there was an enormous passivity to this sort of thing.
And it wasn't – at that point in 1949, Barron, it wasn't that many years since the end of Prohibition, right? The country had sort of shed that, had been through a world war, and I'm guessing – that maybe cracking down on drunken driving just wasn't something very high on the list back then.
That's exactly true. And I do point out from my research that I think the legacy of Prohibition in particular, where we had tried to cut down on alcohol use as strongly as we could, led to a tolerance. No one ever really came out and said it's okay to drink and drive, but there was a permissiveness that allowed people who got caught, people who were driving erratically, to get sort of a wink and nod, to get a slap on the wrist, and then be able to go on their way.
When did groups like MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, when did those groups begin to proliferate and come along?
The first group was called RID, Remove Intoxicated Drivers, 1978, Schenectady, New York. And MAD was founded in 1980 out in California by Candy Leitner. So this was a period of great activism. And they were really the first groups to start doing all this publicity. They put red ribbons on cars and say this is an unacceptable circumstance. And most of these activists had had family members, often their children, killed by drunk drivers who were recidivists, who had driven drunk many, many times, were still on the roads and killed children.
And that was Candy Leitner's story, right?
That was Candy Leitner's story. Her daughter Carrie was killed. She was 13. She was walking down the side of a road going to a school carnival. And the guy who, amazingly, the guy who killed Carrie Leitner, 2 days before had been arrested for DWI and let go, and his license hadn't been taken away. He'd been given a court date. But here was someone who drove drunk all the time, did it 2 days later, and killed a 13-year-old girl. Astounding.
And Barron, Candy Leitner was not someone you said no to very easily, if I understood.
Yes, she was a great activist, a quintessential activist in the sense that she was passionate. She knew how to use the media very well, and she got her incredibly sad story out there and moved many, many people. Some people have estimated, you know, that she herself in some ways saved tens of thousands of lives by getting this issue out there in the early days of MAD.
But help me here, because later she went to work for the alcohol industry.
Yeah, you know, life takes some interesting twists and turns. You'd be hard-pressed to find a more complicated situation than the woman who started Mothers Against Drunk Driving, a national hero, going to work for the alcohol industry. But she did in the 1990s. And she's a smart woman. She argued at some point that we had become too aggressive in trying to monitor social drinking and driving. And she got involved with the alcohol industry, which has been for years and years pushing responsible drinking. And she felt that she had done an incredibly important service in getting drunk driving in front of the public, getting blood alcohol levels down. But she felt at some point that we were being a little too prohibitionist. So she briefly worked for the alcohol industry. And at the time, it raised a lot of eyebrows.
Greg writes this on KCUR's Facebook page, Barron. I was pulled over one night for not signaling a turn, which could have happened completely sober, he points out. I admitted to having a couple of drinks and was arrested and given a breathalyzer, which showed I was under the limit. The officer said I could still be held at his discretion. Bottom line is I had to pay bail, pay to get my car out of the tow lot, and pay a lawyer for something that a judge decided to not even hear because I was under the limit. I was intentionally being conscious of how much I drank that night and was still punished for being responsible. Sounds like a revenue stream to me.
You know, there are – look, I'd be the first to say I heard many cases like this. If you choose to drink even a little bit and get in your car and you – you know, I might argue back that maybe that he would have used his turn signal if he hadn't had anything to drink. You know, I don't know. But you're taking a chance, and once you get into the legal system, you can pay a lot of money and you can even go to jail for brief periods of time. This is why you shouldn't drink and drive. You take that chance all the time. And look, some people who really are pretty safe drivers who are being responsible can be victimized. It is part of the system.
Rick from Prairie Village. Rick, you're on Up to Date with Barron Lerner, author of the new book, One for the Road, Drunk Driving Since 1900. Good morning.
Good morning. A better solution to that last guy that wrote in was he shouldn't have admitted anything to the police officer. Police officer stops you. You don't have to tell him a blessed thing. But that's not why I called. I'm wondering why in the devil don't we use reaction time? Because that would level the playing field. Because it's the reaction time that's the secret. It would also put into the situation of if you're too tired, you shouldn't be driving either. And I'm here to tell you that morning accidents and late night accidents, being too tired is a real issue. It's reaction time and your ability to drive that's important, not what your blood alcohol level is, because quite simply, there are many people that, as we've spoken of early, that seem to be able to drive okay with a higher blood alcohol right. than, say, I would, who I'm a person that doesn't drink very often. Back when I was in my 20s, it was not uncommon for me to stop and have a couple beers with the guys on a Friday evening after work. And I used to, frankly, play a video game before I left to make sure I could operate it.
Hmm.
The game happened to be called Hogan's Alley, and if I could do the 0.07 seconds deal, I knew I was okay to drive.
Rick, thank you. And Barron, how would you test for reaction time, and do other states do it right now?
It's a great point. I think part of the problem is how difficult it is to do that. Talk about subjective. Police officers could do that. Even now, though, when they do roadside testing, and that has been scientifically studied, it's very easy for defense lawyers to call into question the way the testing is done. Look, I think it, as a logistical issue, we've settled on blood alcohol levels as
something.
Because
that's the one thing that's scientific and you can't argue with.
Well, people do argue with it, but at least theoretically, there's real hard data there, et cetera, that you can point to. And with reaction times, it would just be very, very difficult to get standards.
Let's go to Susan from Independence. Susan, good morning.
Good morning. I recently had an opportunity to travel in Norway. And one of the conversations with family, extended family, that live in Norway, they always had someone, if we were going to drive, a designated driver, because no one went out having had any alcohol to drive. It was so accepted culturally that, it just was across the board. You did not drive when you had any alcohol because the response, they took the car away, they took the keys away, anybody, no matter how many times, even if it was your first time, you did not drink and drive. And I was so amazed because their fatalities on accidents, even though they had a high speed limit, like the Autobahn, they had so few fatalities on accidents because people did not drive with any alcohol.
Yeah, Susan, thank you very much. I just want to bring in a comment here from Jose, who writes us at UpToDate@KCUR.org. I think that comparing Europe's lower limit on this is not accurate, since unlike the U.S., there's a very good public transportation systems that go everywhere and run 24/7, and there are sidewalks for walking if close enough. While in the U.S., except for New York or Washington, D.C., if you go out, pretty much you have to drive, even if it is a neighborhood bar, since there are no sidewalks in most suburbs.
In a way, both comments are correct.
Yeah, right.
And make good points. The fact is, it's not just public transportation in Europe that makes this possible. People really, especially in Scandinavia, which has been a leader in the field, this is truly stigmatized. And it's not just the fact that people can take public transportation. There's also an embracing of designated driving. So I was told the story that if you go to a dinner party, for example, in Sweden – the host greets you, the husband and wife, and says, okay, who's the designated driver tonight? And then they ply them with non-alcoholic beverages during the night. So there's a cultural stigma much beyond what's gone on in this country to any sort of drunk driving in those countries. And as a result, the rates are lower. Look, I wish we had better public transportation here and that would help. But I also wish we were much more willing to go to a party once out of five times and volunteer to be the designated driver.
I was going to say, what kind of guest at a party are you, Barron, when the topic turns to what do you do for a living and what's the latest book you've written? Man, that would shut things down pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, I have a history of shutting down parties in the past, so this didn't change things very much.
I sure enjoyed having you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That's Baron Lerner. His new book is One for the Road, Drunk Driving Since 1990. Again, he appears tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. More information for that, kcur.org/up-to-date. And coming up next, Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list.
All I want for Christmas is my two front teeth. My two front teeth, my two front teeth. Gee, if I could only have my two front teeth, then I could wish you Merry Christmas.
Well, I think I recognize you. That's Brian McTavish of KCConfidential.com. What's so confidential about KCConfidential.com? It's confidential, but you
can't
want people
tell.
To look at it,
can't
right?
Tell.
Yeah, you can't tell. Me.
Can't
yeah.
tell. I yeah. try to be as familiar as possible with you every week.
Yes, you do.
On this fine public
yes,
radio
do.
Station.
You're bringing a little bit of Yuletide spirit.
Well, into we'll be the bringing here. It this week and in the weeks to come. What do you want for Christmas? Well,
that's kind of a personal question.
Let me answer it for you.
Yes.
You want a spectacular Christmas concert.
Yes.
Musical Theater Heritage.
Of course you nailed it.
I nailed it.
Yes.
Presents 27, count them, 27 holiday songs from the past 70 years.
And what a great group Musical Theater Heritage is,
too. Oh, they're fantastic. The show is on stage tonight, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and throughout this month. It's December 1. Happy Christmas.
You've got
Christmas
no excuse
month.
Not to go, is what you're saying.
No excuse. Features a gang of seasoned performers. Last year's spectacular ran the gamut from O Holy Night, which I think goes back farther than 70 years, to Chuck Berry's Run, Run, Rudolph, a great rock and Christmas tune, which I'm sure you've...
You're catching me cold. Chuck Berry, Run, Run, Rudolph?
Run. Well, it sounds like all the other Chuck Berry songs, except he tells Rudolph to run.
Why didn't you bring that song instead of the other one you brought?
I could sing it. I better not.
You better not.
The media went crazy for this show last year. The Kansas City Star hailed it as being poignant and mesmerizing.
Mm.
The Johnson County Sun, may she rest in peace, called it wildly entertaining.
Wow.
And KC Metropolis went so far as to suggest that tears of joy were shed, and I wouldn't doubt that. Because they tell very moving, sentimental stories in between the numbers. There's a little bit of a construct going on here. I'll leave the rest to those who go see it. But definitely check it out.
Sounds great. A whole bunch of times. All of Brian's picks are on our website, kcur.org/up-to-date.
Father, forgive us for what we must do. You forgive us, we'll forgive you. We'll forgive each other till we both turn blue. Then we'll whistle and go fishing in heaven. I was in the army, but I never dug a trench. Used to bust my knuckles on a monkey wrench. I go to town and drink, give the girls a pinch, but I don't think they ever even notice me. Father, forgive
I like that guy.
That's John Prime.
That's John, I like him. Liked him for a long time.
Oh, yeah, country folk kingpin.
Yes.
We're all going to be treated to a concert by John Prime, the great John Prime.
The great John Prime, yeah.
Friday at the Midland by AMC downtown. He has written some great, can't say that enough, songs over the years, including, as you may or may not know but are about to, at least one country standard, You Don't Even Call Me By My Name, which I'm sure you've heard before. He co-wrote that with the late Steve Goodman. Prime did not claim a songwriting credit. Which
I
I'm sure
some money.
I think he probably should have claimed one. But it said that Goodman gave Prine a jukebox as a gift for helping him out. And I think the joke would be that every single selection would be, You Don't Even Call Me By My Name.
Yeah.
He's witty, he's funny, he's insightful, he's caustic, he's political.
You can still get tickets.
You can still get tickets. Yesterday I went on and pretended to buy 10 tickets. How do you like that?
Yeah.
You'll probably, hopefully, hear Hello and There, a very moving song about aging and loneliness. I mean...
I love that song.
He's funny.
I love that song.
Right. That's a great song.
You could have brought that one, too.
Well, I could have brought 10 songs. The one we brought, he actually comments. He's great with the audience. He commented on stage during a recent show that it was like he's seen too many Mayberry episodes. You know, Andy and Opie down by the fishing hole. But he also does
you can
a
never
song.
See. No, wait a minute. You can never see too many of those
right.
shows. Don't bring up that topic to a guy like me.
That's true. He'll do Christmas.
I belong to the Andy Griffith Show Rerun Watchers Club, and
all
no
right.
one
oh.
else around here does, but I do.
I think I've Well, I think
tapped
I've,
a nerve.
I've done something.
Yes.
I like his serious stuff, though. I like Christmas in Prison. The title says it all. I like Sam Stone. First line of the song, put you right there. There's a hole in Daddy's arm where all the money goes, and it takes it from there. So he's going to give you – and that's a very serious tune, but he really sheds light on parts of the human heart and, dare I say, the human condition.
Yes.
That they're best to be exposed to as many people as possible. And that's, once again, 8 p.m. Friday at the Midland, John Prine.
Well, John Prine can be funny, and so can your next one here, Eliza Schlesinger. Tell us about it.
Eliza Schlesinger is a stand-up comedian, very young and yet very seasoned. You can catch her at Stanford's Comedy Club tonight through Saturday.
She's Laura's sister, right?
Is she?
I'm just testing your knowledge.
Yes,
here.
Why don't we just say so and dare Laura to call?
There we go.
Is Laura even on the air pitching advice anymore?
Probably.
I think she might be semi-retired. Eliza, I would like to hear her thoughts on the female mind. Could we try that?
Let's try it.
I have a gift for the girls in the audience. I think sometimes as women, we feel that there are a lot of societal pressures on us, right? There's a lot of things to do, a lot of things to consider. From the second you wake up as a girl, and the second you wake up in the morning, your mind is inundated with a billion questions on how to proceed with your day. You open your eyes and it's, oh my God, I'm a fat, I'm a thin, should I work out, should I have breakfast, should I skip breakfast, should I go to lunch, should I call my mom, should I call my dad, should I MySpace, should I Facebook, should I Twitter, should I do yoga, should I do Pilates, should I get friends, should I get a boyfriend, should I get a girlfriend, should I get a dog, should I get a cat, should I get 12 cats, should I call my friends, what should I do?
Wow, pretty good.
Okay, now her contention is that women ruminate about stuff more than men. I ask you, are men just moving through this world while women are busy thinking ahead?
Interesting idea.
What do you think?
I think she might have something there.
Well, I mean, it's kind of funny, two guys sitting here talking about the female noggin. It's
as if we knew anything.
Kind of hilarious all by itself. I did talk to my girlfriend about this, and she does agree that women think more than men. There's a surprise. And they think ahead and think about choices and options. I can't get too excited about that sort of thing.
No.
I turn on the television. I find a good channel. Come back in a couple hours.
Yeah.
You know, I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
But Eliza and my girlfriend, I guess, agree that there's much to be mined in the female mind. Originally from Dallas, this very funny lady now lives in Los Angeles. Here's an interesting fact. Let the first female and the youngest comedian to hold the title of NBC's Last Comic Standing. She also hosts a syndicated TV show called X, like the letter Excused.
And here's an interesting fact.
What?
She attended, my sources tell me, the University of Kansas for her freshman year before transferring to Emerson College in Boston.
You come prepared for
this.
Yes,
I do.
This segment benefits from your presence.
Yes, I do.
Anyway, try to catch the KU grad's show. It might be out there in syndication land somewhere. It's called A New Kind of Dating Show in which rejection has never been funnier. Steve, when was rejection ever funny?
Never fun.
Never fun to me, but maybe it is with Eliza Schlesinger this weekend at Stanford's Comedy Club.
Let's move on to Charles Dickens' holiday rock and roll show. Tell me about it.
This is going to make you smile. I think I see one forming right now.
I love Dickens.
Well, yeah, who doesn't? This is a Dickensian holiday rock and roll allegory. It's a musical called, as you say, The Salvation of Iggy Scrooge. It opens in previews. Well, it's running in previews tonight and Friday. It officially opens Saturday at the Unicorn Theater. Okay.
The Salvation of Iggy Scrooge.
It's a cross between Dickens' A Christmas Carol and rock and roll fantasy. Iggy is a used-up, trashed-out rock and roll star on the quick road to has-beendom who's down on Christmas, and why wouldn't you be if you were Iggy, I guess. Enter the ghosts of rock, reggae legend Bob Marley, Buddy Holly, Elvis Presley, and they set up to vigilantly and hopefully amusingly get Iggy back on a good vibration. Ron McGee is in the show. I bring up Ron all the time. He's everywhere.
He
gets to play Elvis, the ghost of Elvis, unless, of course, Elvis isn't dead, in which case I guess he'd be playing Elvis playing the ghost of Elvis. I can never keep it straight. But that's a funny show to go see.
And finally today.
Swallowed opioid. I am the driver at the wheel of the order, marching suit.
Some call them the best band in the world right now. Who are they?
You know what I think?
Yes.
They're the best band in the world right
now.
Wilco. That's Wilco. Jeff Tweedy and company continuing to be exceedingly cool indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Doing their enticingly
yes.
interesting rock and roll thing at 8 p.m. Saturday. Yes, it's a sold-out show.
Man.
There are ways to get around that. On the Kansas side, don't they have legal scalpers?
Probably.
Called ticket brokers?
Probably.
Anyway, hey, if you know this band, you love this band. If you don't know this band, try to get in if you can. They embrace experimental as well as classic rock and pop sounds, most famously and infamously on 2002's Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
Man.
Yeah.
That's Brian McTavish of KCConfidential.com. Great list, man. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for listening.
I love Wilco. Love them. Visit our website to see the complete weekend to-do list, kcur.org/uptodate. You'll also find more information about all of our guests, our program schedules, and podcasts right there. Tomorrow, the film critics are back to review the latest in art, independent, foreign, and documentary film. We had help today from KCUR's Luke Martin, Kim Noble, and Maria Carter. The show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.
Will you ever join the cold? Come before I die.